listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2021, January 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of the issue's cover story, A Happy New Year, by Karen Valby. Lawrence sips from a white water bottle covered in stickers from her favorite movie, Hereditary, including one of a terrified Toni Collette, who plays the film's main character. Lawrence wears three gifts from her husband around her neck, her wedding band on a chain, a pearl necklace, and a diamond necklace Maroney gave her for her 30th birthday. He'd slipped it into a hardbound edition of Hereditary screenplay, where it lay glinting atop the glossy image of a character's decapitated head on the side of the road, swarming with ants. "It was so sweet," she says with a happy sigh. "Truly, there is a pot for every kettle." At the beginning of Don't Look Up, Lawrence's astronomy PhD candidate discovers a comet of planet-killing magnitude. Her character, Kate, has a red mullet, double nose piercings, a taste in practical sweaters, and an inability to play nice with corrupt politicians, notably Meryl Streep's MAGA-esque president and Jonah Hill's bloviating first son, or a callous, ratings-obsessed media. "Handsome astronomer, come back any time," Kate Blanchett's TV anchor says to DiCaprio's Dr. Mindy after the scientists try to sound the alarm on a popular morning show before frowning in Kate's direction, but the yelling girl, not so much. "No one has more beautiful anger than Jen," says McKay. "When she unleashes, it is a sight to behold. Think of her in Silver Linings Playbook, her in everything." After his last two corrupt white men movies, The Big Short and Vice, he wanted to write a script built in part around Lawrence's capacity for honest rage. "I wanted to cut loose with a strong, funny, truth-teller woman, and that's Jen Lawrence. I mean, that character poured out of me. I would just picture Jen, and you knew exactly what she would say. She's going to be the one who doesn't play the game. And, of course, she's going to be pilloried for it, which will be heartbreaking, but she's never going to play the game." Lawrence plays the disgusted canary in a corrupt coal mine, while DiCaprio is a Fauci-esque character who still wants to trust that the world will take effective action. In real life, their roles are reversed. Lawrence says she recently sent a fingers-crossed text to her climate activist friend with a link to a news story on how nuclear fusion might put the brakes on global warming. He put the kibosh on it pretty quickly. DiCaprio calls Lawrence one of the most talented actors working today, adding, "Jen's ability to improvise and be so in the moment at all times was amazing to witness." On set, Lawrence would joke with her co-star about their child actor histories. "Like, when he went to eat something, I yelled, 'It's sprayed,'" she says. "They used to always tell us that when we were kids. 'Don't eat that, it's sprayed.' They didn't want the young actors eating the props. You only find out when you get older that there's no such thing as spray." In an email, Streep marvels at the duo's differing approaches to the work. She is a bold and unselfconscious actress, someone whose gift is alive on her skin and in her being. In that, she is different from Leo, for whom the struggle is part of the job, who relishes wrestling with it, and whose work is serious and analytic and intense. She spins it out of the air in the room. "I am sort of in awe of both of them." Lawrence says she had one real goal on the set of the movie. "My biggest concern was I did not want to annoy Meryl Streep. That's my worst nightmare. So I will only speak if spoken to, and I will be the least annoying person in the room." McKay says Lawrence was deeply unsure she could trust herself to play it cool. She just kept saying, "I'm going to be quiet. I won't speak." Meryl Streep shows up, and Jen comes over to me like she's a 12-year-old and is like, "What do I say? What do I do?" But Streep immediately pulled her into her generous orbit by showing her Zillow house listings. "And now I would say she's my best friend," jokes Lawrence. So much of Don't Look Up's biting comedy comes from McKay's deeply recognizable send-up of our polarized society. In the film, the far right insist that all the comet hysteria is snowflake fear-mongering. The left flounders in a state of smug and impotent panic, hoping for traction at preening celebrity events like the last concert to save the world. There's a scene in the movie when Lawrence's character returns home to her parents, looking for a soft place to fall. "Your father and I support the jobs that the comet will bring," her mother says. The good news for Lawrence's beleaguered character is that she does get to make out with Timothée Chalamet's street punk. "It would have been a lot more enjoyable," says Lawrence, "if you weren't seeing your aging self next to a 17-year-old in a two-shot who weighs 100 pounds soaking wet. I've never felt fatter and older in my life." In November 2020, Lawrence uploaded a rare video to social media that showed her running up and down the Boston street she lived on during production in her pajama pants, screaming with joy at the news of Joe Biden's win. She was raised to be a God-fearing Republican by her conservative Kentucky parents and a state culture that keeps Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in charge. I ask her if her folks have forgiven their daughter for being her liberal Hollywood self. "I don't know," she says. "I don't really know." Has she forgiven her roots? She's silent for a bit before she scrunches up her face and gives me the finger. "Yeah, I mean, no, there were certain things in the Trump presidency. There are certain things that happened over the last 5 years that are unforgivable. And it's been wild. It's wild to disagree on things you thought you would never. There's no way we're going to disagree on this in 2021. White supremacy, attacking the Capitol, Nazis being the bad guys, or just science. I don't know." Will her parents see her new movie? "Yeah," she says, considering. "Yeah." "Would they see it if she weren't in it?" "Yeah," she says, following it up with a big wink. I tell her that, as somebody who lives in Texas, I honor her conflicting feelings about home state politics. "Well," she says, "if you ever need a schmushmortion, you can come visit me." It's a big swing. We both burst into laughter, and she covers her mouth. Now I'm anxious. There's a moment when Lawrence and I are talking about Don't Look Up that strikes me deeply. I mention the fact that her name appears first in the opening credits, hanging on the screen a half second before being joined by Leonardo DiCaprio's. She gets a pleased little smile on her face before saying, "I was number one on the call sheet, so..." It is a satisfying laugh. Then my own dregs of social conditioning, this nauseating impulse as a female to tiptoe around matters of influence, prompt me to ask, "Are you okay with that?" "With being number one on the call sheet? Yeah. And I thought the credits should reflect that." Leo was very gracious about it. "I think we had something called a Laverne and Shirley, which is this billing they invented where it's an equal billing. But I guess maybe somewhere down the line I kicked the stone further, like, what if it wasn't equal?" There's something inspiring about a professional woman owning her worth. She points to the example of Scarlett Johansson taking on Disney over money from Black Widow. "I thought that was extremely brave," she says. "If two parties understand how a movie is going to be released, and then it turns out that one of the parties did not agree to that, that's unfair. She was also crowning. She was giving birth." Polsky tells me that Lawrence's self-deprecation and humor is her friend's saving grace and superpower. In a social context... Not to feed the "she's just a regular gal" trope, her self-deprecation makes others instantly comfortable. In a professional context, it yields an underestimation of her aptitude. male executives don't anticipate that an actress and walking GIF can probe every deal point on the table until they're dripping in sweat. The bitch is deft. It's only after our first interview that I learned that Lawrence was paid $25 million for the movie, compared to DiCaprio's $30 million. In other words, she made 83 cents to his dollar. These figures are in startling line with Bureau of Labor Statistics data that showed annual earnings for women working full-time in 2020 were 82.3% of men's. That gap is tragically wider for women of color in Hollywood and beyond. When I talk to Lawrence next, I point out the bitter irony of her making less than the man below her on the call sheet. "Yeah, I saw that too," she says, choosing her words carefully. "Look, Leo brings in more box office than I do. I'm extremely fortunate and happy with my deal. But in other situations, what I have seen, and I'm sure other women in the workforce have seen as well, is that it's extremely uncomfortable to inquire about equal pay. And if you do question something that appears unequal, you're told it's not gender disparity, but they can't tell you what exactly it is." Some things that are bringing Lawrence joy lately: autumn in New York, the city opening up again, being able to take Ubers again without feeling you're going to infect your family and die. The pumpkin bread she made yesterday and took out of the oven in time so that the center stayed gooey. Sports and farm animal videos on TikTok. Days after our interview, she'll text me a video of a golden retriever puppy frolicking with his horse friend, writing, "I mean, Jennifer Coolidge's performance in White Lotus. Talk about somebody who knew the effing assignment. Bravo's Real Housewives." Of a Potomac star, she asked, "What do you think about Candace's husband being her manager? Ugh, that is not a healthy dynamic." The door behind her rattles, making her laugh. "What if Cook just came in here like, 'I want to be your manager?'" Lawrence could write a dissertation on the mesmerizing toxicity of Salt Lake City housewife Jen Shaw. "She has the strongest case of personality disorder I've ever seen in my life," she says. "You know those people who don't take any accountability ever, to where you almost feel jealous? Total lack of accountability, lack of shame. I'm almost like, how dare you? I lie in bed worrying about accidentally hurting someone's feelings, worrying about everything. That's probably why it burns my biscuit so much." Lawrence had been so worried before this interview. She felt awkward about not wanting to talk more about her baby and her husband and the sweet future they hoped to build together in private. "I did have this whole fantasy of just doing the whole interview off the record." Early into our conversation, I told her she seemed like she had a gun to her head. "Oh my God, I'm so sorry," she said. "It's not your fault." There's a scene in Don't Look Up where DiCaprio's panicked scientist begs a glib reporter to take seriously the need for actual engagement with each other. "We don't always have to be clever or charming or likable," he says. "Sometimes we need to be able to say things to each other and have an honest conversation." So here's what I say to Lawrence. She has a right to her boundaries. May they serve her and her family well. By leaving her baby out of our conversation, she has already started mothering her child. Lawrence has to go to the bathroom again. This time she remembers to mute the recording. She smiles, her mouth making words I can't hear, and gives me a big thumbs up on her way out of frame. queen of the desert. The Arab world once struggled to embrace her, but 5 years after Zaha Hadid's death, several of her extraordinary buildings are being unveiled across the Middle East, and her legacy as one of the 21st century's most innovative architects only grows. By Joseph Giovannini. Opening photo, Otherworldly Oasis. The United Arab Emirates Bayat headquarters, shown here under construction, will open in 2022. In the fall of 2009, city buses rumbled through Rome, plastered with close-ups of a wind-blown Zaha Hadid, promoting the opening of her National Museum 21st Century Arts. Maxi, as it is called, was leveraging the architect's celebrity to advertise her more Baroque than Bernini new museum off the ancient Via Flaminia. So when the Iraqi-born Hadid stepped out of her limousine at a balmy museum opening in 2010 in a white off-the-shoulder tubular coat paired with sequin-spangled fingerless gloves and punky black boots, the paparazzi were waiting and ready. It was Anita Ekberg from La Dolce Vita all over again. The opening, after nearly a decade in the works, Rome wasn't built in a day, was a high-wattage moment that cemented Hadid's celebrity. Like Evita or Liz or Beyoncé, Hadid was now Zaha. Within all the Zaha brouhaha, however, there was a quiet, reflective moment. A thin, scholarly, soft-spoken 68-year-old gentleman in wire-rimmed glasses, Sinan al-Shabibi, governor of the Central Bank of Iraq, approached Hadid, then 59, would she consider designing the bank's Baghdad headquarters? Al-Shabibi was the son of a statesman who had known Hadid's own statesman father, Mohammed Hadid, both from a grand, cultured, aristocratic Iraqi families. Like Zaha herself, Al-Shabibi feels had spent decades in the Iraqi diaspora during Saddam Hussein's rule. The Economist was asking the London-based architect to come home, as he had done, and in a way asking her to build on the legacy of her father, who had been the nation's finance minister after its July 1958 revolution, eventually drafting the law that nationalized the country's oil industry. The question was all the more poignant because she had reservations about the Arab world's interest in her work, even as she began to receive commissions in the region late in her 40-year career. "My biggest failure has been in the Arab world," she once stated in an interview. "I don't think Arabs respect me enough, because I'm an Arab. Arabs like foreigners. If I was an American, they would love me, an American man." Moreover, the commissions she did receive had a high mortality rate, casualties of regime changes, oil price fluctuations, budget cuts, and the Arab Spring. With the central bank and then a handful of other projects, Arab power brokers in more stable environments were coming around, calling her back to a world that had marginalized one of its own. She was keen to work in the Middle East and was very interested in new opportunities there, said Sarah Sheikh Akbari, an Anglo-Persian associate director working at Zaha Hadid Architects. She felt at home there. In fact, her office saw exponential growth and exponential fame from around 2007 to 2011, and the central bank headquarters was one of a half dozen personally gratifying Arab commissions from that period, or shortly thereafter, that are now opening or nearing completion this winter in an arc that stretches from Morocco to the Gulf. Hadid's fatal heart attack in 2016, at the peak of her career and talent, meant that she would never live to see nearly half of her major built designs, including the forthcoming projects. With some 30 substantial buildings completed in the past 5 years or in the pipeline, the architect has arguably proved as imminent in death as in life. And despite the internecine battles that have surrounded her estate, executors have fought in court for years, not since Eero Saarinen's posthumous masterpieces, such as the TWA terminal and Dulles International Airport, has an architectural afterlife been so successful. For her new Arab clients, Hadid was the right architect at the right time. Her avant-garde, world-class buildings are icons for a rising Middle East. Leaders keen on burnishing their country's profile as a progressive state. While leaving a personal architectural legacy, commissioned photogenic monuments that would elevate its stature and cultural cachet. Charismatic in a way Hadid herself was charismatic, each Zaha declared its individualism and cultural independence. The slow liquidity of her lava-like buildings broke with the stiff classical columns of colonial times and Europe's modernist boxes, grids, and symmetries. Besides, the forms were captivating, flowing like dunes. If you squinted, their sinuous lines recalled Arab calligraphy. A Zaha would guarantee a city press and screen time. Her fame, she was an art world and Arab world rock star, would rub off. Next photos, Baghdad grandeur, architectural renderings of the Central Bank of Iraq headquarters now being topped out. And Iraqi icon, Zaha Hadid, photographed by Brigitte Lacombe, 2012. Some of the commissions, like Iraq's bank building, had a personal dimension. According to Hadid's office, Al-Shabibi told bank executives that there was only one architect to consider for their headquarters. Hadid was the most famous Iraqi alive, widely admired for her global triumphs. Her Joan of Arc aura, the pride her countrymen took in her success, and the trust in this native daughter with a historic family name in a country where relationships matter deeply, all sealed the deal. After signing the contract at a formal ceremony attended by Iraqi diplomats at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, Hadid said that her father was in the room. The 34-story concrete, glass, and steel skyscraper is now being topped out in Baghdad on the banks of the Tigris. The organically shaped mullions on its heliotropic facades intertwine like stalks, turning geometrically with the path of the sun to protect the building's interiors from Iraq's brutal solar load. Hadid and her team sculpted the blast-resistant podium in long rolling contours. The spaces inside roil like white water. Hadid and her colleagues derived the forms from the angles of the sun and the flows of rivers. As if shaped by nature, it resembles a tall plant growing along the Tigris. Hadid also conceived the high-tech tower as a kind of college of construction, where local engineers, architects, builders, and artisans could tool up their expertise to competitive international standards. Her Iraqi peers did a crash course on the building. Her office has worked on the skyscraper through Iraq's recent turmoil, including the ISIS crisis, and since 2014, without pay. Jim Heverin, the project director and one of the heads of Zaha Hadid Architects, says, "We've stayed involved because we wanted to do the building for Zaha." Next photos, Royal Rail. Riyadh's metro station, depicted in a rendering, is near completion. And Hadid Habitat, modular classrooms meant to serve Syrian refugees in Nizip, Turkey. Like Frank Lloyd Wright, with his cane, cape, and pork pie hat, Hadid branded herself wearing Yoji Yamamoto and Issey Miyake, topped off by her scorching red lipstick, gravelly voice, and year-round tan. But her inventive designs, not her aplomb, earned her the commissions and the fame. Many of the projects were won in competitions, as in the angular, elasticized King Abdullah Petroleum Studies and Research Center, started in 2009 and finished in 2017, and the substantially completed King Abdullah Financial District Metro Station in Riyadh, where her design fulfilled high Saudi aspirations. They wanted the best, most beautiful transportation project in the world, explains project principal Gianluca Racana. The aim was iconicity, a building that could recognizably be identified with the city. Drivers in this car-choked, freeway-gridded capital can now ditch their vehicles by parking in the belly of the metro station, a building that imports a Saharan mirage of stacked dunes into an otherwise eventless, treeless cityscape. The facade, a porous sunscreen of undulating arches, cools and veils the four stories and six rail platforms inside. Columns bent and inclined in waves brace against the thrust of decelerating trains. Like the wooden mashrabiya that cover windows of traditional Arab houses, the latticework shades the interiors, allowing breezes inside induced by the whoosh of trains. The structure, which mixes transport with shopping, dining, and workspaces, breathes like a lung. The movement of trains suggested airwaves, says Racana, which recalled winds shaping the dunes that we evoked in the facade. If the architects imported the metaphor of the desert into the middle of the Saudi capital, they were dealing with the actual desert in the United Arab Emirates for a state-of-the-art headquarters in environmental and waste management. In 2013, Sheikh Sultan III of Sharjah, one of the Emirates, convened six architects in his manor house in Sussex, England, to decide the winner of a competition for the Biah Center. He started by reviewing Hadid's design, and the Emir never quite made it past her models and drawings. He liked them so much that he had to be coaxed to see the others, and during the discussion, he investigated moving the site itself to a location where he could see the building from his palace. Hadid and her fellow architects channeled the desert through the idea of wind. Using 3D modeling software to mimic patterns in nature, they composed a building of intersecting dunes that grow out of the sandscape. Swept up into cresting shapes, surrounded by an oasis of palms and pools, the architects punctured the dunes with computer-generated motifs that created dazzling constellations of light, evoking decorative Arab starburst. For all its beauty, Biah checks all the environmental boxes: LEED Platinum certification, a low carbon footprint, and solar energy captured and stored in Tesla battery packs. As Hadid completed projects and became better known, powerful Arab figures came to trust her personally. Her commission for a soccer stadium in Qatar, which, among other new stadiums, will host next year's World Cup, confirmed her friendship with Sheikha Mosa bint Nasser, wife of the country's former emir. When the influential Sheikha asked Hadid to design contemporary classrooms that could accommodate young Syrian refugees in Turkey, the architect accepted, taking on the program pro bono. Graceful, tent-like structures now serve grade school students near the Turkish-Syrian border. Hadid's resident mathematical genius, Shajay Bhushan, helped plot out the billowing domes, engineering inexpensive, luminous polycarbonate sheets to provide natural light while protecting against the sun and heat. Over the last several decades, the sophistication curve among Arab leaders has climbed steeply. For a younger set, sometimes educated in the West, Hadid became the cool architect. For a generation that didn't want the Louis XIV of their grandfathers or the bland, functional modernism of their fathers. So when Hadid's submission failed to win a 2009 competition for an opera house in Casablanca, The king of Morocco, Mohammed VI, then 45, admired Hadid's losing design and invited her to build the theater in the capital, Rabat. He would transplant the plaza-oriented concept to a former floodplain recently tamed by a new dam built upstream. Hadid toured the site with her close business partner and the firm's heir apparent, Patrick Schumacher, along with an entourage of office colleagues and the governor of Rabat. Wrapped in a filmy shawl and wearing big square sunglasses, she didn't dress down for what was basically a site visit to see some land. Zaha took a great personal interest in the project, says Nils Fischer, her project director for Grand Théâtre de Rabat. The path of least resistance would have been to import the Casablanca design, which the king already liked. Instead, she proposed designing a building that responded to the riverine site, and then proceeded to redesign the landscape itself by forming an island surrounded by the Bouregreg River and pools. "We started from the topography," says Fisher. "The island and building would be a stepping stone between the two ancient cities, Rabat and Saleh, on facing riverbanks." The oppositional flows of the Tidal River on the Atlantic drive the shape of the building, pushed and pulled into molten, glass-fiber-reinforced concrete figures that merge with the contours of the island and riverbanks. The buildings lift, creating terraces and natural bridges and arches through which pedestrians will walk on landscape promenades. The forms tail around an outdoor amphitheater for 7,000. The theater inside seats 1,800 within a fractal hall partially hand-hammered in brass by artisans in Marrakesh. Hadid has designed Morocco's answer to the Sydney Opera House, and as a legacy of Mohammed VI, Grand Théâtre takes pride of place near an adjacent plateau occupied by the mausoleum that houses Morocco's last two kings. Next photos, Morocco Mirage. Grand Théâtre de Rabat sits on the banks of the Bouregreg River. And solar spot, Riyadh's King Abdullah Petroleum Studies and Research Center, finished a year after Hadid's death. For Hadid herself, there was a private side to the business of building in the Arab world. Perhaps the monuments for her clients were symbols of cultural arrival, but for Zaha, the trophies were vehicles taking her back to her roots. The homecoming put her in direct contact again with a world she missed. Despite her often brusque demeanor and sharp tongue, she could swear like a truck driver. She had, as all her friends noted, a huge heart, and she was touched and gratified at the chance to reconnect with the culture of her youth, a culture in which her spirit resonated. The sadness is that she will not be stepping out of a limousine at the opening, wearing a shimmering designer cloak and a pair of drop-dead shoes. But like her father at the ceremonial signing of the Central Bank of Iraq contract in London, she will be in the room. She signed all her buildings. There is Zaha in every Zaha.
Thank you.
down to earth. Jeff Bezos' hand-picked successor, a CEO of Amazon, is in many ways his antithesis, understated, modest, and relatively unknown. But can Andy Jassy manage a $1.75 trillion company, its 1.4 million employees, and a seemingly inevitable regulatory onslaught, all while maintaining his nice guy reputation? By Nick Bilton, with opening photograph of Andy Jassy by Sebastian Kim. It was just another Tuesday in Seattle when Andy Jassy sat down in his office at the Amazon Reinvent building, one of many on the sprawling campus, to take what would end up being the most important phone call of his life. Seattle is often gloomy and wet during the winter months, but on this particular January day, the rain was torrential, slamming against the windows of the 37-story high-rise. In the distance, the Seattle Space Needle disappeared between the clouds, as if it were threaded through the sky. Inside the building was quiet. Jassy, who was 5'10" tall, with an oblong face and short, spiky hair, was dressed in a variation of the same outfit he always wears. A dowdy button-down with worn-out jeans and leather high-tops with a white sole. That day, just like every day for the past 2+ decades, Jassy had been the first person into the office, arriving in his 1998 Jeep Cherokee Sport, the same vehicle he has been driving since moving to Seattle in 1997, when he took a job at Amazon the Monday after he finished business school at Harvard. Unlike most Amazonians who worked from home as the COVID-19 pandemic ravaged the world, Jassy had been making the trek to the office from his home in the Capitol Hill neighborhood to run Amazon Web Services, or AWS, the biggest cloud storage business on the planet, with more than $50 billion in annual revenue, more than double that of Salesforce. A few hours earlier, Jassy had received an email from his boss, Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, asking if they could talk on the phone. Bezos-level requests weren't a regular occurrence for Jassy, usually landing in his inbox every couple of weeks. So such a note meant there was something important to discuss, perhaps a problem in one of the company's 36 divisions, which oversee everything from top-secret government contracts to the making of toilet paper. Jassy's seventh-floor office was a panopticon of whiteboards, each one filled with endless Amazon-related to-do lists or ideas. He had so many whiteboards that his office walls were barely visible. Some of the notes on the boards were so secret that he would cover them during meetings. That day, he sat at his desk and dialed his boss. Bezos greeted Jassy with a bit of small talk, some personal, some business. Then, out of nowhere, Bezos said something Jassy never expected to hear. "I'm contemplating stepping away from the CEO role at Amazon," Bezos said, as recounted to me by Jassy. "I'm happy to keep doing the role, but I'll only stop doing it if you're excited about being the next CEO and my successor." "Can I think about it for a couple of days?" Jassy asked, surprised and excited by the prospect, but obviously taken aback by the seemingly sudden offer. "Of course," Bezos replied. Jassy is a creature of habit and tradition to an unusual degree. He meets each of his two kids, a son and a daughter, for breakfast once a week, always independently, on the same day, at the same time, and has done so for years. He hosts the same weekly, monthly, and annual sports gatherings at his house. He schedules 2 hours for himself on his calendar once a week to read, often Amazon-related memos, and on Tuesdays, as he's done for the past 25 years, he has a date night with his wife, Ilana. That night, seated outside at a local restaurant with plastic domes installed over each table to help separate patrons from one another, with the rain pelting down on them, The Jassys discussed the pros and cons of taking the biggest and most visible CEO job on the planet. Were he to accept, Jassy would oversee 1.4 million employees at a company with a market capitalization of more than $1.75 trillion. He would oversee the divisions that build electronics, make clothing, sell books, grow food, procure data, and dish out pharmaceuticals, not to mention continuing to oversee his brainchild, the Cloud Services Division, which props up most of the Internet. If he chose to take this daunting job, he would be responsible for Amazon's Alexa, Ring, and Twitch, Whole Foods Market, IMDb, Comixology, Audible, Amazon Studios, the makers of The Boys and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, not to mention hundreds of fulfillment centers, a mammoth supply chain, and countless other businesses that start with Amazon, Amazon Advertising, Amazon Fresh, Amazon Drive, and on and on. This job would inevitably lead him to be dragged in front of Congress, cameras glaring and angry politicians trying to tear him apart, where he would be forced to answer questions about Amazon's monopolistic business practices and a slew of antitrust issues. He'd be ridiculed on TV, turned into a million unflattering animated GIFs on social media, and see his name and face shackled to the front pages of 1,000 newspapers. It was a role that would put him on the front lines of the war with Amazon employees trying to form unions, where he would have to personally hold at bay tens of thousands of competitors and stave off foreign governments that want to break Amazon into a million little pieces. Perhaps most difficult of all, if he took this job, Jassy would somehow have to sustain the truly astounding growth trajectory of the company, which continues to show a 37% increase in revenue year over year and brings in $443 billion in annual revenue. I was surprised, Jassy told me, recalling that Tuesday call with Bezos. I wasn't anticipating it. I wasn't clamoring for it. I loved my current job, but I was obviously flattered and excited by the prospect. Sure, it had a lot of cons, but the potential pros for Jassy far outweighed them. A few days later, Jassy called Bezos back and told him, "I'm in." It takes a certain kind of personality to want to run one of the largest companies on the planet. Recent psychological studies have found that as many as 20% of corporate CEOs display psychopathic tendencies, meaning a huge percentage are thrill seekers who feel no empathy for others and thrive on revenge. Bezos certainly has at least some of those personality traits, but Jassy, as far as I can tell, does not. At least not yet. When the announcement went out in early February that Jassy would be taking over as CEO of Amazon, Wall Street wasn't sure how to react. Analysts felt comfortable with Jassy as the new head of the company. As one tech investor told me, if AWS was a standalone business, it would likely be valued at close to $1 trillion. And they were also relieved to know that Bezos would be hovering above as chairman. But while the stock rose 1% on the news, it did not skyrocket as, say, IBM's did when it announced a CEO change. Sure, Jassy ran one of the most profitable segments of Amazon's business, but Bezos, who had started Amazon 27 years earlier, formulating its massive potential on his laptop while on a cross-country road trip, wasn't just an icon of American business, he was the icon of modern American business. Bezos was a killer, to quote Logan Roy of Succession, and it was that instinct that had led him to grow the company in limitless size and scope. Unlike Bezos, who is as famous as an A-list Hollywood celebrity, Jassy is largely unknown beyond those familiar with cloud computing jargon like SaaS and CRM. One Amazon analyst noted that at the time of the announcement, Jassy instantly became the most Googled person on Earth. Over the past couple of months, when I mentioned to people I was writing about Andy Jassy, almost everyone responded, "Who is he?" The questions about what would happen next at Amazon were endless. Could a guy who runs a cloud computing division run all of those entities? How much more could he grow a business that was already worth almost $2 trillion? And perhaps most important, as Amazon approached one of the most volatile times in its history, was Jassy a killer? When I've written about other tech CEOs, Jack Dorsey, Mark Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, even Bezos, there has always been a seemingly infinite line of former employees, old friends, or co-founders, usually those who felt they'd been wronged, who have been all too happy to vociferate in great detail how effed up their old bosses were as human beings. When it comes to Jassy, though, I couldn't find one person who could, or would, say a bad thing about him, and trust me, I tried. All anyone would say was how nice and unpretentious he is. His college roommate, Tom Salentine, told me he'd seen Jassy's niceness back in their Harvard dorm room days. Once, Jassy was worried that a fellow student studying for a test wasn't eating enough, so he began leaving food by his door each night. His older sister, Kathy Savitt, told me her brother was born nice, grew up nice, and is still nice to this day, maybe even nicer. He's one of the most likable people I know. His friend Rich Fontaine, whom Jassy met 30 years ago at his first job selling porcelain collectibles, told me Jassy is also the most humble person he knows. He honestly doesn't give a shit. A long list of current and former Amazonians, Rick, Jennifer, Maria, Chris, David, and so on, talked endlessly about Jassy's nice guy-ness, not only within Amazon, but outside of the company as well. He donates time and money to nonprofits for cancer research, volunteers with programs that help kids in developing countries learn how to read, and is on the board of a nonprofit that helps low-income and immigrant families gain access to higher education. I came away from 24 interviews unsure if either the Amazon communications staff had cleverly debriefed everyone who had ever interacted with Jassy over the last 53 years to say almost exclusively nice things about him, which is plausible given the way tech communications departments work, or if Jassy had indeed spent the past decade of his career only collecting admirers and making few, if any, enemies. When I ask Jassy if he's ever done anything wrong in his life, or if as a kid he ever got into trouble, he simply said he never had time to. He was too focused on school and sports. If you were to believe all of his friends, family, and colleagues, it's as if Fred Rogers walked onto the set of The Office. But even Mr. Rogers had his issues. One person who knows Jassy told me he can be so boring you'll want to gnaw your own arm off when talking to him. And some employees say Jassy's attention to detail can sometimes be maddening, that he gets into the weeds on issues far beneath his pay grade and obsesses about them. One example took place a few years ago when a hurricane knocked out power to one of the AWS data centers. Generators had been installed precisely for a situation like this, but when an employee flung open a door to the generator room, the back of the door hit an emergency shutoff button, which took the entire data center down. According to someone who worked with Jassy, rather than just tell people to move the switch, he held countless meetings about the incident and became personally involved in deciding where in the room the switch was moved. Which leads to the question of the work environment at AWS. In July, 550 AWS employees signed a petition that alleged an underlying culture of systemic discrimination, harassment, bullying, and bias against women and underrepresented groups, and sent it to Jassy, as well as his successor as executive of AWS, Adam Selipsky. A letter I got my hands on that was sent to AWS employees by Selipsky noted that an outside firm had been hired to investigate and understand any inappropriate conduct that you or others may have experienced or witnessed. Last year, an AWS employee named Loudon Williams left the company, explaining in a LinkedIn post that the culture in his division had become toxic. In the post, he recounted a story where a colleague said to him, "Amazon's greatest strength is its ability to self-correct, and AWS is the only business I've encountered at Amazon that fights that self-correction." Jassy has not been accused directly of engaging in race and gender discrimination, but senior people he has hired over the years have. With his reputed attention to detail, is it possible he didn't know? Amazon said that the company has begun addressing the issue by creating women-led groups within AWS and creating an anonymous ethics hotline, but the company is still waiting for the results of the investigation. If Jassy is described today as a nice guy, his former boss was once seen that way too. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.